This is a WATD Political Forum on 95.9 WATD. Online at 95.9WATD.com. Now, live from Studio B, here's your moderator, WATD's Christine James.
And good evening and welcome to a WATD Political Forum. I'm Christine James, your moderator here in studio, asking questions with Monday night talk show host and reporter Kevin Tachi. Tonight, the race is for an open seat for the state Senate. Plymouth Norfolk seat held for several decades by State Senator Bob Hedlund, now Weymouth Mayor Bob Hedlund. We have the two Republicans vying for the seat, as well as the two Democrats all in studio with us, hoping to win the primary election. That's on April 12th, and get their name on the ballot as their party's nominee. The election is May 10th. On the Republican side, we have Patrick O'Connor and Stephen Gill. For the Democrats, we have Joan Moschino and Paul Gannon. Now, the Plymouth and Norfolk District, in case you're wondering, if you were in the towns, Weymouth, Scituate, Norwell, Marshfield, Hingham, Hull, Duxbury, and Cohasset. First up tonight, we have the Democrats and then the Republicans. Now, our format is simple. If you're a regular listener to WATD, you know we always use the same format. We've asked the candidates to have prepared opening and closing statements ready. They can be as short as they want, but no longer than 2 minutes. Then we have a round of questions from the reporters, a lightning round, my favorite part, where the answers are either yes or no, and that's not yes or no with an explanation and a long-winded soliloquy, or two sentences tops. The reporter will tell you what they want. And if there's enough time, the candidates can ask each other a question or two. Also, we tell people, please try to keep your answers to around a minute. If you consistently go over, ramble, or start to repeat yourself, then you know what happens. That's right, the bell, still here. We chose the opening and closing order out of the official WATD Newsroom Koozie just moments ago. So we're going to begin with Paul Gannon, and then we are going to go to Joan Moschino. We will reverse that order at the end. So good evening, and let's start with our opening statements. Let's begin with Paul Gannon.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate you putting this debate together, this forum together. And I've been doing this for approximately 8 months. I started in July, and it's been very rewarding. I've met a lot of wonderful people, and I'm motivated to get to this April 12th day. I'm looking forward to it. I mean, I've told people along the way that the reasons I'm running are multiple, but basically I want to make sure people that get equal opportunities. It doesn't always happen in our government. I want to make sure that people are treated fairly, and that doesn't always happen. And I want to make sure that people that can't speak for themselves, the most vulnerable in our society, that I give them a voice. And one of the best examples I can give you of what I'm talking about is a month after I was elected selectman in Hingham, I initiated a program not only for Substance Abuse Prevention Coalition, but also helped start a fundraiser for Special Needs Athletic Partnership, where these young kids in the communities, not only in Hingham, but also now in the South Shore SNAP, are given opportunities to participate in athletic activities that in the past they weren't given that opportunity. I think the way we're going to accomplish this thing is we're going to make sure that we're accessible and accountable to the voters. I've already started that by getting involved in the programs such as SNAP, getting involved in the opioid epidemic issue in terms of starting a group in Hingham and working with the Coastal Connection down in Hull, Weymouth, and Cohasset, and Norwell. So I look forward to the opportunities to get out in the neighborhood and provide education and opportunities for the residents.
Thank you very much. That was Paul Gannon. Now let's go to Joan Moschino.
Yes, thank you so much for having us in here. It's been a quiet race, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to introduce myself to everyone. I've been a lifelong resident of the South Shore. I grew up in Hull, and from early on, I understood the value of hard work and education, and yes, I did actually work on my father's lobster boat as a sternman growing up as a kid to put myself through college. In fact, I spent much of my career fighting for people without a voice. I'm the director of a nonprofit called Massachusetts Appleseed Center for Law and Justice. It's a public interest law center that promotes equal rights and opportunities for Massachusetts residents looking at systemic solutions to social justice issues, and most of that work for me has been around access to public education. About 12 years ago, I became involved in my community. I ran for selectman, and I have was very fortunate to serve for 6 years. I loved it tremendously. And since that time, I've continued to represent the town on regional boards and commissions. And it's really given me a wonderful opportunity to get to know the South Shore, both what's different about our communities, but also the things that we share. And it's really shaped my views on what we need in the South Shore for a bright future. And it's given me a strong appreciation for how I would approach my role if I should be as lucky to be elected state senator. One of the things that I think we need to do is to start to come together, think about ourselves as a region, and advocate for the resources that we need to invest in our community to make a bright future. So thank you. I'm delighted to be here and introduce myself to people. If people want to learn more about me, I'm actually having a kickoff event tomorrow in Hull at the Nantasket Beach Resort from 6 to 8, and everybody's welcome to stop by.
Thank you very much. That was Joan Moschino. Now we're going to go to Kevin Tachi. First question for the candidates.
We'll start with you, Joan, and that is you have experience as a former selectman. How do you feel that translates into success on day one at the State House if you are elected in May?
Oh, I think actually everybody should have to do a stint as a selectman before they run for higher office. What it means is that you have experience dealing with the issues that matter to people. Good government is about making government work for real people. And as a selectman, you work closely with your legislative delegation and you establish good relationships and you actually learn very quickly how it works on Beacon Hill and what you need to do to advocate for the things that your town needs. As a senator, what it would really mean for me is to start advocating for the region for what each of our towns needs and what we need together, and it will translate right from the get-go.
Paul, my question to you is being a current selectman and a former state rep, how do you think that translates into success day one for you?
Well, I tell you, it gives me a great balance. You know, being a selectman is let me see on the ground level the municipal government, how it operates, funding, the needs we have, and I was also a member of the school committee. As a state representative and even as a prosecutor in Suffolk County DA's office, I got to see how things work on the state level. You put those things together, I've got a great perspective. Not only did I serve up there, but I know the players up there. I'll be able to hit the ground running literally once the day I get in there, and it's been brought to my attention that obviously there's budget issues immediately. I'll be prepared to address those from the get-go. And I'm a small business owner, I'm a parent, I have kids that are in college, we pay mortgages, I can relate to the issues that affect the folks in my district.
Okay, any follow-ups?
No.
Paul, I'll start with you this time. As a former state representative, you know the way things work on Beacon Hill. Had a few retired state legislators speak to us very, very off the record about what things are like up on Beacon Hill. And it's basically, if you don't vote with leadership, forget it. You're never going to get a leadership post. They're going to lock you out of things. And they need independent voices here on the South Shore. We've had a lot of people who've come through these halls and have run for office. So many of them have said they are going to be an independent voice. But when it comes down to it, we look at the votes. They're always voting with leadership. Are you going to be the same? Or are you going to be different?
Well, I can tell you something, that I've always been independent. I've always been my own person. I've always gone against the grain and did what I thought was right, even at whatever the cost might be. I'll give you one example. When I was in the legislature, there was a lot of pressure. Folks that were working, men and women, were getting pressured through a lockout bill. And lockout situation where they couldn't get any unemployment benefits. I was asked to sponsor it, which I gladly did. And then the pressure came from all sides to try to water it down, to try to eliminate it. I stood firm. I stood with the working men and women. The law passed. I was literally on the Hill recently walking with them. There was the only elected official, the only candidate to stand with them, again, the gas workers. And what they said to me was, they introduced me to the younger people, said, this is the guy, without him, we would have lost everything. So that's what it's all about to me, standing up to, whether it be the leadership or standing up for what's right. To me, it's the same thing. You do what's right.
Okay. What about you, John? You get elected, you're going to be up there first time, state senator, you got a lot of districts, and you're going to get a lot of pressure to always vote lockstep with leadership. How do you feel about that?
I'm not worried about that. I think I have a strong record for being an independent advocate for social justice. I mean, that's my job right now at Appleseed. I've written legislation. I've advocated for legislation. I have great relationships with both the House side and on the Senate side. Currently, I'm not concerned about that in the least. I think that my record is pretty clear that I have my own brain. I do my homework. I think for myself. I listen, try to build consensus, really work the relationships and move things forward because that's the right thing to do. And I always have good principles for what I'm doing, good reasons for what I'm doing, and I just work the system.
Thank you very much, Joan. Now, Kevin Tachi, question for the candidates.
The opioid drug epidemic is far from over. We know that it's something that's happening right here in our own backyard. As changes are being implemented when it comes to the treatment or amount that doctors can subscribe from time to time when it comes to first-time patients, some are calling actually for tougher penalties on those who are convicted of drug trafficking. Where do you stand on this issue, Paul?
Thank you. In fact, that question was posed to me recently in a Patriot Ledger article. And being a former prosecutor, being an individual who has a master's legislator introduced and had legislation passed to stiffen the penalties for heroin trafficking, I know very well, and I'm sure Joan does as well, that the penalties that are in place are very, very effective. I'd always be willing to look at something if in terms of protecting the public. But my focus right now, being involved in my substance abuse coalition and working with the folks on the down the coast from Hull all the way down to Marshfield and Duxbury, is that we're looking for prevention, treatment, and education. You know, this is where we need to go. But I will tell you this, that I fully supported the governor's initiatives to try to limit the amount of prescription medication being doled out to people. It was far too overly aggressive, and it was being harmful. So I'm coming up. We'd like to come up with some new ideas in the legislature to address those issues.
Same question to you, Joan.
I agree. I don't think that anyone still believes that deterrence works. I think the focus right now is much more effective to be on prevention. When you look at things and how they work in a system, it's really trying to prevent the initial addiction and keeping people from heading down that path. So I agree. I think it should be things like prevention, oversight for prescriptions, and then we're going to have to beef up a little bit around some of the regulatory oversight to really help and put some of the systems in place, educating doctors how to assess pain, how to write better prescriptions, assess their patients better. The other piece, I think, is that we should be focusing on deterrence and the drug courts. We just had Rep. Cantwell successfully got the Hingham District Court. And so when you're getting people into these programs, the other piece is making sure there's access for beds and for programs, so that once they do step forward and we've eliminated the stigma, they actually have some resources to help them to avoid the opioid addiction.
So I want to see if I get this straight. You feel, both of you seem that you're along the lines that you're more worried about the prevention. What about the people who are bringing in the heroin or distributing the fentanyl? Do you not feel that there should be a stiffer sentence that will prevent people from wanting to sell that in this state?
Sure. Well, I think the recent legislation that was introduced about fentanyl is a very good step. All I'm saying is that we have some very, very strong measures that put drug traffickers. The legislation that I sponsored back in the 90s increased the penalty by decreasing the minimum you had to have for the heroin. So these guys are going to 3 to 5 to 10 years. These guys aren't getting slapped on the wrist by any means. So I'm very comfortable with that. I just think that you have to have a balance. You have to, you know, and right now there's so many.
So you're against mandatory minimums?
No. The legislation that I introduced,
yep,
was mandatory minimum and actually lowered the threshold so they had to go to jail for mandatory 3.5 years.
Okay.
So I was, in the right circumstances, I am all for that and always have been as a former prosecutor, as a legislator. What I'm saying is that you have to have a flip side of that. And the flip side of that is you have to be, you know, the way things are now, it's an epidemic. And that, yep, means that it's gone way beyond where it should. And we need to take any steps as serious as they may be. And the governor's proposal was a great one. I supported that, and the legislature passed that. Fentanyl was a good step. There are many things that we can do, but we also need to get some funding for treatment. The drug court is a great option, and that's been around a long time, so I've been very supportive of all those things.
Same question to you, Jim.
Oh, I agree. I don't think that deterrence works at all. And I started out as a criminal defense attorney, and I could tell you that the sentencing is pretty stiff. I actually disagree that we should have mandatory minimums. We have an excellent judiciary here in Massachusetts. It is unparalleled. And I think you should be giving judges the opportunity to assess who's in front of them and figuring out what the sentencing should be. But there's, I mean, it's a... it's a tough sentence. You're in, if you get picked up for traffic and you get adjudicated, you're in jail for quite a long time. So I don't think that anybody thinks
could,
that...
Could I clarify something on that?
Sure.
Sure. I just want to make one distinction is I am in favor of mandatory minimums. I think that they have a great deterrent, and there has to be a certain amount of deterrent. It doesn't mean that my focus is not on that. It's just that I'm trying to help people in need, communities, and families. But I will tell you that being a former prosecutor, I know for a fact that having those mandatory minimums is a deterrent, it is effective, and the punishment is can't be altered, and that is very important in our justice system.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit more about the drug issue, since that we do so much reporting on it, thinking about it, mm-hmm. analyzing it. And just going back to a couple generations and remembering when other drug epidemics have come through here, say in the 70s, the 80s, but this is over all-encompassing and overwhelming. But one thing I always remembered about something like this, and I was thinking a little bit back, I know I'm kind of rambling here, but thinking about, since I'm a little bit older than both of you, remembering what the culture was about drinking and driving and how Mothers Against Drunk Drivers kind of, there was a sea change in how people started to think about, you're not going to get in a car and drive drunk because things are going to happen. And it became part of a cultural shift. It took a number of decades, but it happened. What's going to happen with this whole drug epidemic unless the culture changes, that it's acceptable for some kids? I know they say it's a disease, but some people that get hooked on drugs, they think it's acceptable to do the kind of experimentation where you could become hooked on it. How do you make those kinds of changes? Because until you make a cultural change, or peers, especially young people, thinking that it's not cool to take drugs or even take a chance, not much is going to change, no matter what kinds of laws you enact. Joan, what do you think about that?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I'm voting against legalizing marijuana. I think that's a terrible message to send to children, to youth and young adults. You know, parents struggle to keep their families and their children safe, and you can teach values, but if it's so prevalent out there, what's the message we're really sending with that? So I think that's one place to start. You know, when we talk about drug addiction, it tends to get wrapped up in casual drug use, drug addiction itself, prescribing for the opioids, but also mental illness. And so we have to really unbundle a lot of those issues, which is one of the reasons why I really feel strongly that we should be focusing on the prevention piece. So not even writing, you know, you can walk into your doctor's office, tell him you've injured yourself in an industrial or some sort of an accident, and they'll give you 30 pills right off the bat. I've had that happen where you say, well, no, I don't need that. I don't need that many, or not even sure I need any of it at all. And they're like, no, just take it just in case. That's mm-hmm. the kind of thing we have to stop. And it starts in that doctor's office, how they're assessing pain, because every patient's different, mm-hmm. but then also what they do with that information and how they write those prescriptions. And that's, I think, the piece that we're both saying is important to get at, to start to change some of that piece. But then the other attitude is around stigmatization and making sure that everybody feels like they can step forward and get the resources. But if we're going to ask them to do that, we also have to provide the kind of programming that's going to really help.
Sure. And I know I asked a long, rambling question before, but how do you make a cultural shift in the attitude towards taking drugs? Because a lot of people, especially young people, think it's acceptable. Mm-hmm. I hear it. We hear it on the street. We hear people talking in court about some things they think are just a complete joke. How do you change that, Paul?
It's not going to be easy because the ballot initiatives recently with medical marijuana and decriminalizing certain amounts certainly, in my opinion, may send the wrong signal to the young men and women. I think those are the folks that are most difficult to convince that it is dangerous, it is a problem. But there was just a special legislative group in the Senate that actually looked at this whole issue, and I supported wholeheartedly the conclusions they reached. And one of the things they were talking about was drinking and driving or using drugs. And I know firsthand that it's very difficult to measure that and to allow people to be using even a gateway drug, which I call marijuana. It almost says that it's okay. And when we're dealing with this epidemic today, I don't think we want to send mixed signals, especially to our youth. We need to show them that all drugs are dangerous and illegal drugs should not be allowed.
Okay, thank you. Kevin?
I guess I want to kind of shift to something else, and we can circle back around to the drug issue if need be, but there are other issues within the district. I think one of the other big issues that we have in the district is in regards to the national flood maps, the flood insurance premiums issue. I want to get an understanding as to what you guys know or your understanding as to what's going on and what you can do as a legislator to help if the time comes that we need the legislative delegation to do something, go down to Washington, whatever it may be. Joan?
Oh, I think that's a huge issue for us. I mean, climate change and sea level rise is going to impact the whole South Shore in our region. So, you know, first off, one of the biggest disgraces was that those FEMA flood maps weren't even accurate. So kudos to our legislative delegation, led by Rep. Cantwell in particular, working with the federal delegation to go back and make them take a look at them and make sure that they were accurate. And I think that's a great example of something that impacts everybody, where we come together and we share our issues and we leverage our shared voice and we start thinking about it and advocating for things as a region. That's how you get things done. You can't even get insurance now. You have to go through all of the programming through the state on the South Shore. And this impacts just the value of our homes, the business community. That's why I'm advocating strongly that we need to be investing in our infrastructure and really thinking about how we're going to resolve some of these issues. And it's all about working the relationships. And I'll be a tough advocate up on Beacon Hill as well as the federal level advocating for our needs.
Sure. One of the things that I've always done, I've been a team player, and I think this is an issue that epitomizes something that needs a team effort. And it has happened up to a certain extent, but we need a senator in there who's going to be, you know, roll up his sleeves and get him very involved. So I can tell you that on a municipal level, not only were the Matt McDonough and the folks down in Marshfield, but my office in Hingham and other communities down the coast, all were working in terms of maybe we took a different approach, but we all challenged the FEMA maps. And we did that with the assistance of our state legislators, and I'm sure Jim Cantwell would agree that Garrett Bradley, Josh Cutler, and Tom Coulter were all very much involved in that, working with Congressman Keating and Lynch to do the best we can. And I think they did a great job in basically forcing FEMA to reevaluate. And that's the way I would address the issue, is working with folks that I already have been developed a relationship over a long period of time, especially in the last 8 months.
Okay. Joan, earlier you mentioned talking about doing things regionally. And one of the things, if you listen here regularly, you know we love to take pot shots at county government. They're still trying to figure out exactly.
Dan, are you listening?
I know they're all listening, and I'll get angry texts afterwards, but I expect that. We're still trying to figure out exactly what they do. And are you a supporter of county government? They're always talking about doing things regionally. We're not exactly sure exactly what the timeline on that is. Are you a supporter of county government?
No. Well, I shouldn't say no so quickly as all of that. I mean, 4-H is important in those kinds of things, and we have our court systems and we have our jails. But no, what I'm talking about is really thinking about the South Shore itself and thinking about where is the planning that we need to be doing? What are the shared issues? So one example would be the South Shore Chamber has been really looking at a lot of data and the changing demographics and thinking about what are the strategies that we need to do to come together to really figure out how to grow small and mid-sized businesses.
What about county government?
Well, I just don't see how county government has been helping. I think there could be a robust role for them, but they just don't seem to be embracing that.
Okay.
I've lived, actually, for a few years. We began our career down in Texas, down in Dallas, Texas, where county government is primary, and it does everything, mm-hmm. and it really brings together all the resources and can be very effective. But up here, we've moved away from it, and I think we've sort of winnowed away those resources. They're not there, and we're going to have a state senator in there who's willing to really work with the state reps in our area and do that for ourselves.
I think, Paul, your community of Hingham took one of the most proactive steps, I think, in actually having a study about county government to see if there would be a change if you dropped out of that or didn't. I'm not quite sure what the final outcome was, but what are your feelings about county government?
Sure. I think when I was elected selectman, we were in the midst of the study, and we basically, the charge was to, you know, continue along, and there were strong feelings either way.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you, at the end of the day, and if there's a lot to criticize about county government, there's a lot of issues, and obviously they could be a lot more effective. And I think they've taken some major steps. So I'm certainly willing to work with them. The study that we took basically, in essence, concluded that it wasn't practical for us to try to break away from county government or to eliminate it. So I think there is so many reasons not to, but it doesn't mean we don't work hard to try to make it a better place and so that it benefits the residents of the county.
Okay, thank you. Kevin Tauchi.
Both you having served on the municipal level will understand this particular question. It seems that many communities on the South Shore are struggling to put together municipal budgets, especially when they need to appropriate sufficient funding for education. That's kind of a key cog. What needs to be done on the state level to help communities that are struggling to fund their school budgets annually?
Paul? Well, boy, that's like it hits home because not only was I a member of the school committee who advocated for quality education and funding for so many programs, and believe it, there's not enough money to go around.
Right.
But I think something that epitomized that, and just one last thing I'll say is, even in our budget last year or two, I voted to give them more money for the schools because I know they need it and we need to find the resources. But I guess that flips me back to what the some of the school committees are doing now is, They're getting a 1.6% increase in their budget from the governor, which is woefully inadequate. We basically operated at 4% because of contracts and so forth. We need to find additional funding and prioritize that because the needs of our children, we're facing potential layoffs in Hingham. That's not going to happen. I'm doing everything I can to make sure that we level fund and fund projects that are going on. But it may involve public-private partnerships. We need to find creative ways to come up with more money to fund not only building fields and so forth for sports, but also for providing educational opportunities in the schools.
Same question, Jen.
Oh, I think we need to be focused on this. And I'd actually be very interested in starting to take a look at the funding formulas, the foundation funding formulas, to make sure that some of the policy initiatives that we're really looking forward towards are actually things that we're funding and that we're assessing against and that we're actually meeting those goals. The 1.6 percent increase, that's essentially a cut because all of our costs remain the same all of our costs increase but they increase, like Paul was saying, at a higher rate. So to say that they're increasing that budget is really not true at all because it remains a cut to small towns. We're not funding early education, which we need to be doing for every child in the state. Special ed continues to be a challenge because of the way that the rules work and how you get reimbursed for that after the fact, but you still have that educational obligation moving forward as the child presents. So I think we really need to start thinking about, how much does it really cost us to educate a child, and are there other costs that are related to things like special ed or children in poverty, and how is the state government actually funding those things for us? And that's what we really need to start thinking about, because right now the formula is not working for the cities and the towns that actually need it the most.
And just a reminder, you're listening to 95.9 FM in Marshfield, WATD, South Shore's news and information station. This is a political forum. These are the Democrats that hope to be on the ballot for the Plymouth and Norfolk State Senate seat.
I get a follow-up, and it's in regards to funding. Do you feel Prop 2.5 needs to be modified or abolished?
No, Prop 2.5 is fine. It doesn't need to be modified.
There are some communities that would disagree with you.
No, I agree that. I understand that. But the whole premise behind Prop 2.5, I think, works just fine, and you have your opportunities if you want to be doing an override or a debt exclusion.
Okay.
So you have your opportunity if you think your town can afford it and you need to do it, and it keeps the control, local control and municipal government, and the towns that feel they need to do that and can afford it will do it, and if not, they don't.
Paul?
Yeah, I wouldn't have much different to say. I would say my experience in Hingham has been that there's a lot of folks in town, whether they be senior citizens on fixed incomes and so forth, that are struggling right now. So one of my pledges has been not to raise taxes for folks this year. I think I may be the only candidate that is taking that position in line with the governor and the speaker. But as Joan says, I think there's mechanisms in place. I've seen it do it in Hingham, and I know they've done it in many other towns. If they need money, the democratic process is to come out and vote on an override. And not only have we done that, but in Hingham, we've also set aside money such as meals tax and so forth to kind of cushion the blow when these tax rates go up. So we're still looking at our seniors and taxpayers while we're helping out kids in the school department.
Okay. State Senator Bob Hedlund was one of the most independent voices in the State House, whether you call him a Republican, a Rhino, a Libertarian, a Populist, or just the rock and roll senator. He had a lot of support from many different kinds of constituents, even in some communities where the thinking the Democratic vote was going to go for the other candidate. He kept winning. And this district is one of the most heavily Republican-weighted in the region. How do you think you could win over all these voters, Paul?
Well, I think you need to do, and maybe taking a page out of Bob's book, which, you know, again, I don't necessarily follow all his leads, but in terms of he was able to reach out to Democrats, Republicans, and Independents. You know, from the moment I started campaigning, I've been able to do that. I've been able to speak to folks, address their concerns, and listen to what they have to say. So, you know, my focus is going to be on bringing everybody together, working together. And, it's my nature. So I think that the big thing that you need to do, that what I hear when I go through the district, is even when Bob was in there, is that they want to see me. They want to see us in the district. They want us active, accessible. And again, that's my nature. That's the way I operate. I'm looking forward to doing that. Again, I've been doing this for 8 months. And I don't just sit and vote as a selectman. I wouldn't just sit and vote as a legislator. I get involved. The opiate epidemic issue is the best example when I helped create that coalition. That is something that's very important to me, and that'll be epitomized what I do in the district as a senator.
Okay. What about you, Joan?
You know, I agree. I think that people in this district think for themselves. And I think one of the things that's most important to people here is that they know who their elected officials are. We have had a long tradition. I know you started by saying it's very conservative and weighted Republican. But in fact, I was shocked to discover how many people are actually unenrolled. And I think that people like to meet their candidates. And I think that they like to know that they're going to work hard for them. And I think as a state senator, that's what I'm really offering. Is that I'm accessible and available. I give out a business card with my cell phone on it. You can call me. So I feel that it's really about establishing relationships both with the local elected so that all of the issues percolate up to the state reps and also up to the state senator. And I think the other piece that I would just emphasize is that Senator Hedlund was very much an independent thinker and an independent voice, but it's about teamwork. And I think what I think is most important right now is that the state senator work closely with the legislative delegation. We have some great state reps with us right now, and they're both Republicans and Democrats in this particular district. So it's about teamwork. It's about understanding what our district needs. It's about common issues and leveraging our shared voice and really getting in there and fighting for the resources we need to make for a bright future.
Follow another comment.
Sure. Yeah. I want to say that I don't disagree that the district, as I see it, may be a little more conservative than other districts. And I think that's one reason why I think I'm going to be the best opportunity for the Democratic Party to take that seat back after 20 years. Because the positions I have as a former prosecutor, as a state rep, being involved as a small business owner myself, having a family, being involved in the ups and downs of raising a family with kids in school and the cost of education and paying the mortgages, I'm uniquely qualified based on my experience to appeal to everybody across the board, Republican, Independent, and Democrat.
Okay. Kevin, you have a follow-up question? If not, we're going to go to lightning round.
No, we should go lightning.
Okay.
Okay, let's go to lightning.
Okay.
It's not like a bolt of lightning is going to come out. Describe yourself. Are you, and you can describe yourself in a sentence or two, are you a liberal, moderate, or conservative Democrat? Joan?
Liberal Democrat.
Okay. Paul?
Moderate Democrat.
Okay. Kevin?
Biggest accomplishment as an elected official? Biggest accomplishment, Joan?
Two sentences.
Oh, when I was a selectman, we hired a fire chief, a police chief, a town manager, and I think that those are the kinds of hirings, those are the kinds of things that really set up a community.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you. Paul?
There's many, but the quickest one, the lockout bill, because it saved people's livelihoods, it saved people's families, and they come back and thank me 25 years later for doing that.
Okay, good.
For or against Common Core? Paul?
Two sentences.
I'm for Common Core that works, and right now it's not working.
Okay. Joan, same question.
Against Common Core. We were just fine without it.
Okay. Who do you support in the presidential election, Joan?
Hillary.
Okay. Paul, who do you support in the presidential election?
Undecided.
Okay. Kevin.
In one or two words, describe your opponent, Joan.
Interesting question.
So this is the lightning round.
Okay, come on.
Paul is a solid candidate. He's got some decent experience behind him, and I think he's made for a good dialogue between us to really have a good democratic dialogue.
Is she working for you?
Yeah. Maybe you have to hit 12.
Hey, you asked me to be fair. You asked me to be fair.
It's okay. Same question for Paul?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, I would say a very intelligent, warm, personable person that I look forward to working with in the future.
Okay. Very nice.
All right, I'll throw this out. Where would you like to sit on a plane? Aisle seat or window seat?
Window seat.
Window.
That was the boxes of brief question.
I was not supposed to tell people I asked that.
I like to see where I'm going.
I didn't. You did.
Okay. Any other lightning round questions? Okay.
No, we're good.
Okay, and I got my county government question in there.
Yes.
We have a couple of minutes. Would you like to ask Paul a question, Joan?
Well, I do actually want to ask you a question, Paul. You know, we've had a lot. One of the big things that has come up every single time is around public schools. And as you know, I'm a big supporter of public schools. You know, I think we should be doing early education and care. I think straight through K through 12, up to affordable and accessible quality higher education for lifelong learners and set kids up. But one of the things that you've talked about in the past and I'm concerned about is charter schools. And, you know, as a state rep, you voted for the original authorization of ESEA that included charter schools, and I was just wondering if you could talk about that.
Well, I support, when I was in the legislature, we had an education reform package, which was highly touted.
Oh, I'm sorry, I apologize.
So,
that was what I was talking about.
I will never apologize for making schools better and making them more efficient and giving a better quality of teaching. I certainly would not. So I don't think I have anything to apologize for, but I appreciate the question.
Okay. Paul, a question for Joan.
So recently, the Boston Globe South printed a story about rising home owner tax rates, which will increase in all 8 towns of our Senate district. What, if anything, have you done in the past to keep taxes in check, and what would you do as our senator to address this problem?
So I have, as a selectman, one of the things that I've been very proud about doing has been to make government more efficient and to really work for the people. I don't have a problem with actually thinking about a progressive tax rate and to shift the taxes off of poor people, off of people in the lower income quintiles, on to higher income tax bracket people. Because the fact of the matter is we do need revenues, Paul. A lot of the things that you and I have both been talking about, we just had a long discussion about the opioid, and those are the kinds of programs that require funding. So I actually think that there's two parts to that answer. You need to make sure government is actually working for real people and making sure that government is providing the services that we all need. And I think people are okay with paying for that. It's when government grows unchecked. It goes back to your question, Kevin, talking about the 2.5 proposition. That's the check and the balances. We have a wonderful institution called Town Meeting, and people who go to Town Meeting look closely at the budgets. They think about these issues, and they work closely with selectmen, state reps, and their state senators. So thank you for the question, but I think that that's an important piece that we have to take into consideration.
We're going to go to closing statements now, and if you feel that there was anything that we asked during the forum that you wanted to add something to, this is the time to put it in there. You've got 2 minutes, and we're going to reverse order with your closing statements, and this time we're going to start with you, Joan Moschino, candidate for Plymouth and Norfolk State Senate.
Oh, thank you. So I'm running because I have the experience, the relationships, the perspective, and the commitment that our district needs on Beacon Hill. You know, my years of experience as a local elected, but also as a social justice advocate, uniquely qualify me to work with the local electeds, with community leaders, with business leaders, with residents, to really tackle the issues that are important to all of us and to fight for the South Shore on Beacon Hill. I believe good government should work for real people. I do plan to be an independent voice for the South Shore. And, you know, I'm hoping that people have heard the kinds of issues that I've been talking about and the questions that you've illuminated here today. I think that it's incumbent upon us to do our homework, listen to the people in our district, to think about what we're doing, have principled reasons why we're doing things, and make the best decisions with the information that we have in front of us. That's why I've stepped forward. I love the South Shore. I've lived here most of my life, and I think we need to be taking a regional approach, and that's what I look to be doing, and I see the role of the state senator as. So I'm asking people to please, on the primary is April 12th, please come vote for me, and that does happen to be my birthday, so hopefully you'll all remember that, and find that I'm the best choice for the role, and vote for me on April 12th.
Thank you very much. That was Joan Moschino. Now we're going to go to a closing statement with Paul Gannon.
I want to thank you again for having us here. It was a pleasure, and hopefully it's been informative to the folks that are listening. I want to thank Joan as well for participating. It's always good to work with you, and sometimes these forums are good to be able to show distinctions between our positions. My position all along has been that I'm the best opportunity for the Democratic Party to take back this this seat after 20-plus years. I think something you just heard just a minute ago is probably one of the better examples. The difference between Joan and I is that I don't agree that we should be raising taxes and not looking at the repercussions. I think that there's my experience in the district, whether it be Republican, Independent, or Democrats, they're all struggling, whether it's to pay tuition, to pay the bills month to month with mortgages. And people that I speak to, they don't want to be paying higher taxes so that we can pay for more programs. What they want us to do is to cut the waste in the programs in the budget now and use that money for education and so forth. So I think that's a great example of the distinction between Joan and I. And I will tell you that I think that the person who's going to win this election, whether it be Democrat or Republican, is going to have to be able to reach across the aisle. On April 12 is my election and May 10 is the fall. But reach across the aisle to get the support of the majority of the people in the district. And I think that's a very critical issue. I look forward to working continuously on the issues that are most important, like education, the opioid epidemic. I'll use all my experience that we've spoken about, small business, public service, and I'll do the best job I can, and I'll be out in the district as often as I can listening to my constituents.
Thank you very much. That was Paul Gannon. You've been listening to the two Democratic candidates running for the Plymouth-Norfolk State Senate seat. We're going to have this entire forum up on our website, 95.9watd.com, and selected cuts from this will run on Wednesday morning. If you wait and stick around for a few minutes, we'll have the Republicans come in here. You're listening to Monday Night Talk. I'm not Kevin Tachi. I'm Christine James, but Kevin Tachi's right next to me. We'll be back in just a few minutes.